Thank you, Sue. Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It is Thursday, January 21st, 2021. And the next matter on our calendar for oral argument is Progressive Direct Insurance Company versus Namara. I will introduce myself first. I'm Louise Bjorkman. I am joined on the panel this morning by Judges Diane Bratfold and Jeffrey Bryan. And we are here for oral argument. Counsel, you will each have 15 minutes to present your argument. Counsel for appellant, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. It's important that you state your name and identify the party you're representing when you begin your argument. And so with that, counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. I am Andrew Horstman on behalf of appellant Elizabeth Namara. Mrs. Namara is listening into the argument today, as well as co-counsel for Mrs. Namara, Chinedu Nawaneri. We are asking this court to reverse the trial court and enter judgment for appellant Elizabeth Namara. The issue in the case is whether Mr. Isiaka Traore had permission, either express or implied, from Mrs. Namara on February 4, 2016, when he took her truck she owned, drove it without her knowledge and consent, and caused an accident to a party insured by Progressive. The trial court said that its decision was based solely on the law, but the law, specifically including the law cited by the trial court, does not support that decision. The facts are fairly straightforward. Appellant Elizabeth Namara owned a house in Brooklyn Center that
Mr.
she was
Marston, yes. Before you proceed to discuss the facts, I just want to make sure you aren't challenging any of the district court's findings of fact, are you?
No, we are not challenging any findings of fact. The facts are essentially undisputed. Appellant Elizabeth Namara owned a house in Brooklyn Center.
Mr. Horstman, let me jump in, yes, because I am curious about that. The determination, I'll use that word, that the district court made regarding implied permission or consent. Some might look at that and say that's a fact finding. And it doesn't seem like you would dispute that. If that were a fact finding, you would dispute that determination.
I dispute that in this case because of what the trial court said, saying its decision was solely based on the law. I certainly have seen the cases where the Supreme Court has indicated that this determination is a finding of fact to be determined by the jury or the court sitting as a trier of fact. I don't know why the trial court in this case said it was solely a matter of law, but our challenge is not to the facts, but the inferences the trial court drew from those facts. So I don't think a counsel for Progressive will have a dispute with the facts. I just mean to state them for context at this point. Mrs. Namara owned a house. She was having it renovated for use in her business providing services to disabled adults. As part of that renovation, she had a truck parked in the driveway at the house that was used for errands related to the renovation. At some point before February 4, 2016, she allowed Mr. Traore to sleep on a couch that was still in that house. It was the only piece of furniture in the house. She did this because he had to leave a place where he was staying, had no other place to stay, and then would have been sleeping outside, would have been homeless without a place to stay. So she provided shelter. At no time before the day he took the truck, was there any discussion between the two of them about using the truck, driving it, taking it under any circumstances. And the appellant has said she would never have given him permission to drive it. Mr. Traore had his own car. He didn't have a place to stay. He needed shelter. but he didn't need transportation. So there was no discussion of that before this event. On February 4, 2016, he took the truck and caused the accident. Mrs. Namara was out of town at that time. In saying it was making its decision solely on the law, the trial court went through the cases we should be looking at here to determine what the appropriate inference to draw is.
So, counsel, I just want to stop you for a question, yes, a second, and say that, you know, your summary of the facts reminds me that if agency law applied to this case, then we would be looking at these facts that you've just described, which I think are largely undisputed, through one lens, but we're not looking at it through agency law, right? We're looking at it instead through the Safety Responsibility Act, and specifically the provision that seems to create a presumption of permission based on ownership, right? That an owner, normally someone doesn't drive someone else's car unless they have permission. Now, that was a very specific policy decision by the legislature, wasn't it, to create that presumption?
I would not agree that it's a presumption, Your
Honor. Okay, that's what I need to hear, counsel. I need you, yes, to address specifically the legal analysis of this district court in relying on that Safety Responsibility Act. Because I agree with you. I don't think the facts are disputed. Okay. I'm trying to think of which are. I can't think of any. So go ahead.
All right. Let me get to that then, Your Honor. Thank you. The Safety Responsibility Act is what we're considering here. And the language in particular is an owner will be responsible if someone uses their vehicle and causes an accident with their consent, express or implied. So consent is required. In this particular case, we're not considering express consent. There is no indication there was such, and the trial court found that. So it's just, is there implied consent? There's not a presumption that there's implied consent. There's a requirement that there be that.
No, and I didn't mean to suggest there was a presumption of implied consent, but there is a prima facie case stated by a plaintiff, I think. I think there's a lot of case law that supports this, and some of it was cited in respondent's brief. A prima facie case presented by a claiming party under that act if they're able to show ownership. Right. I'm saying presumption. There's a prima facie case. And then the issue is there express or implied consent? Which is, you're right. That was the issue our judge focused on. Nothing about express consent. That's not an issue here. But implied consent is. Correct. So I guess what I'm trying to do is get you to go to the burden of proof issue, because I think that's the core legal dispute here.
I will go that, yeah, that, Your Honor, and then come back to the two cases that I think control whether you find implied consent here, Stewart versus Anderson and the Kleiman case, or Kleiman case, K-L-E-M-A-N. On the burden of proof, Progressive seems to be taking the position that it's essentially a matter of absolute liability unless the owner of the car somehow can disprove any basis for finding implied consent. The case is cited, however.
Let's go right to the case. It's Lumbermans, isn't it, that we're looking at?
Yes.
It's a Minnesota Supreme Court case, and that's the one the district court cited in its opinion when the district court decided the burden of proof.
Well,
by the way, I mean, you didn't object to that decision in district court, right?
The decision was rendered the morning of the trial, Your Honor.
Yeah, but the district court asked for briefing and you didn't provide any briefing on it, right?
No briefing was provided at that time. Okay, I would submit that the burden of proof decision, I'm sorry, I cut you off, Your Honor.
Yeah, what I want to ask is, so did you forfeit this issue?
No.
Why not?
Because it's the court made the decision as a matter of law in the trial order. It didn't make the decision before then. This is something that supports the judgment of the court. And our issue with it is that she transferred or expanded the entire burden of proof to the appellant when the cases make clear that what they are discussing is what happens in a situation where some initial permission has been provided, and then later there's a subsequent use, and the owner of the vehicle is saying, I didn't approve or give consent for that subsequent use. Under those circumstances, the burden has been shifted to the owner to disprove or show that the subsequent use was not within the bounds of the initial permission. Those are typically cases where a parent has allowed a child to drive on one occasion and then disputes that the child had permission or consent to do so later.
Mr.
Yes.
Let me ask you this. I mean, I appreciate the factual distinctions between some of the cases you've cited and our case. We're not dealing with a family member. We're not dealing with a family member whose boyfriend drives the car. But as I read Lumberman's and some of the other cases, the legal principle as to the burden of proof being on the owner to show there was no express or implied consent, I think applies across the board. Why am I wrong?
Well, Your Honor, Lumberman's and the later cases in particular, I'm thinking of Milbank Mutual against the United States Fidelity and Guarantee, and then Christensen versus Milbank Insurance Company, which is a 2003 case, have referred to this as the initial permission rule. I think recognizing that whether it's Lumberman's or Shuck v. Means, in both of those cases, there was no question about initial permission being given. And indeed, our trial court recognized in an earlier opinion in deciding the motion for summary judgment that it wasn't clear, well, some case law in her view was clear as to what termination of permissive use and conversion was, but less clear as what amounts to giving permission or lack of consent in the first place. And that's what we're looking at here. We're not looking at someone trying to say a subsequent use was not within initial permission. There was no initial permission. The first time Mrs. Namara learned that Mr. Traore had taken her car was when she returned from being out of town and saw it wrecked in her driveway. So there certainly can be no inference based on their prior contact that she had given him that initial consent.
Can't implicit consent be inferred? Two levels of implication. By the fact that the truck is right out there in front of the house and the keys are in a cupboard in an area of the house that's to which Mr. Traore has unfettered and unrestricted access?
Well, I wouldn't call it unfettered. It certainly wasn't locked, but it was a key in a cupboard behind a door. He had to find it. When he found it, we don't know. He was provided shelter. So you may imply uses and additional things related to shelter, as I've seen in the briefing. Yes, could he use the bathroom? Certainly. Could he take things out of the house? The only furniture that was in there was the sofa. He was allowed to sleep on it. I don't think we'd infer he was allowed to take it and move it to his new house if he wanted to whenever he found new shelter. He was given shelter, not transportation. And when we look at the cases the court looked at, Stewart v. Anderson.
So counsel, I think that the district court, I'm just watching your time and I wanna make sure you have a chance to respond to it. The district court was persuaded by a couple of facts. First of all, that Ms. Namara never had a discussion with Mr. Traore about the pickup that was in the driveway. No discussion at all. Okay. And secondly, that when Ms. Namara returned from vacation and she saw the demolished, I mean, inoperable now pickup that she had previously relied on, she did not pursue anything with regard to Mr. Traore having taken the truck, you know, didn't make a theft claim, didn't follow up with the police to challenge the property damage that he caused to her, nothing. So would you address those? They seem to have been significant to the district court.
Yes, Your Honor. The fact that there was no discussion, I think, is an issue that was specifically addressed in the Kleeman case, where the court said there was no need for the parent to have that discussion because there was no awareness of a prior use. And that's exactly the case here. There was no reason for Mrs. Namara to be discussing that with Mr. Traore. He had his own car. He had never asked for permission, and she wouldn't have given it to him if she had. When she returned, and I don't know what the misunderstanding was or if it just seemed futile to do something more, the truck was there. It was inoperable. She couldn't use it. And as she said in giving testimony, she thought the police had already issued a report, which they had, on the incident. So didn't see that as something that would have been useful or helpful. I see my time is up, Your Honor. Unless there are further questions, I'll defer.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Young, you may present argument on behalf of respondent.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. Can I be heard? Am I being heard, I should say?
Yes, we can hear you.
Thank you. I think that there is this is kind of one of those classic cases where the conclusions and the facts and the law are kind of merged. A finding, it's as if implied permission is a fact, but it's also a conclusion drawing from the facts. And so I think that the district court may not have been clear as to what exactly facts they were finding. The trial court was finding, but they were clear because there was no dispute as to fact. The court found—
I guess the more precise question for me is, what is the appropriate standard of review for what I'll call the determination of consent?
Well, I appreciate Your Honor looking at it as a determination. I think that the standard of proof, the standard of review is it clearly erroneous. The case now is fleeting me, but I think there was a clearly erroneous case that was used in the implied permission decision before. There's an appellate court case, and I'm hoping that it'll come back to me, the case, but I think clearly erroneous. The district court watched the witnesses. The district court saw facial expressions when things were being testified to. And although there's no dispute as to the words that were said, for example, Your Honor, we have a homeless person in the house. I don't think that compares to parent and child that was discussed by counsel. Parent and child has a history, especially one who's driven, is over 16 years of saying yes, saying no, giving limits. This was a homeless person invited into the building, and there are only a few objects. There's a couch, there's a vehicle, there's keys, there's a bathroom, but it befuddles me that there's no discussion as to the limits of what the person is allowed to use. And
that kind of goes to the central question I have, and that's whether or not you see this as kind of a zero or a one, or is there some other option? If you look at this evidence, we're trying to infer consent, permission, if you will, or not. And the decision depends on if it's silent. What is the conclusion? If there was no express, then what do you look at to determine implied? And I say, do you think of this as a zero or a one, or is there a third option? In other words, can you imply non-permission, or can you imply non-consent from facts?
Yes, I think that you can, Your Honor. If you put the keys in a lockbox,
right. No, I'm not saying what facts would lead you to that conclusion. I guess I'm saying under this statute, if you have competing inferences that can be drawn from the same facts, what do you think? This goes to the burden of proof, I guess. You have competing inferences from the same facts, an inference of non-permission, and you can conclude that from the fact of the keys being in the drawer and not out and about. And you can infer, as you're arguing, consent from these facts. So what does the statute say if you can infer two different things from the same set of facts?
Then I think a fact finder drawing the conclusion, which, you know, we don't have a jury here, so I don't know what jury instructions and special verdict form would have been given to a jury to find the facts. But here we have one individual, the district court, deciding those conclusions. And I think, Your Honor, that the district court can infer from the facts one way or another.
So what and, more could the owner do than what was done in this case to imply non-permission?
A simple no is the first thing.
Right, but that's expressed. Let's just say imply, right? We're looking at what implied non-permission. So based on someone's conduct alone, what more could someone do beyond, let's say, put the keys in the drawer and close the drawer? What more can someone do without expressly saying, don't use my car, to imply non-consent?
I'm having difficulty answering that, Your Honor, because it seems like it almost has to be expressed to get rid of implied.
So if that I gets me back my... to, right. So then I come back to, are we really saying that you are either expressly telling someone they don't have permission or under the statute because of the burden or the, let's call it a prima facie, as you would probably agree with that characterization, that there's a prima facie case or an assumption or presumption that ownership equal that you are deemed the agent of the owner in the words of the statute, right? So if there isn't conduct from which we can imply non-consent, then really you do have either express non-consent or implied consent. It's one or the other, right? And if you don't expressly tell somebody don't do it, then under this statute, you've given permission impliedly.
I think that's accurate, Your Honor, if you have the sum of the things of the vehicle being available, the keys being available, when you have those things, I think that Your Honor may be correct. And I'm including express negative permission that doesn't even have to be verbal. This gentleman could have been in the kitchen, standing there with appellant, and appellant could have picked up the keys, put them in the drawer and shook her head and waved her finger. I think that's expressed nonverbal. I think that there can be things like that, Your Honor, but I don't know what would be an implied non. I'm having difficulty with that concept because a no usually is expressed.
So counsel, would you talk about the Kleeman case? Because it's certainly one that the appellant relies on significantly. I know you already said, well, parent-child cases are different, but you know, we need to look at the case law that's out there. And Kleeman is a case where the parent had not prohibited their child from driving the car. The parent was completely unaware that the child had been driving the car and the parent left the keys available and accessible. In that case, the district court found that the parent was not liable under this act.
I agree, Your Honor.
The facts seem quite similar to what we have in the Maris case. So tell me how we look at it. The court there expressly said, parent is not required to lock up the keys. Parent is not required to expressly tell their child that they can't drive the car.
Your Honor, I think that there is less similarity than your question is giving me, Your Honor. I think that there was multiple uses in the Kleeman case by the child that the parent was unaware of. That wasn't here. There was, in some ways, by silence, a deception by the child over multiple times. And having your keys in your own home where your child is, I think is a kind of an all, we all do it, unless we now have a reason to not have the keys available to the child. Some other instance where we are aware, oh, the child's been using the car, not supposed to be using it, I'm going to take some steps. That parent didn't have this. In this instance, the case, or Merritt's case, she let a homeless person into this building and it wasn't her home. There really was no reason for those keys under her description. So again, no dispute as to fact, she left the keys there, but she said those keys were left there in case of an emergency. But then she goes on to describe that not an emergency involving Mr. Traore, who's living there, but never really describes who's going to use it in case of an emergency. And the person, since it's not somebody's home in her family, they could just simply bring those keys. It just, that seems inconsistent to me. And it's kind of borderline, excuse me, this is not a negligent entrustment case, but it kind of, it almost sounds like that. And leaving these keys with a person, you have no idea who, what they're like. She's described him as homeless. And so I don't.
Counsel, I think I follow the distinction you're drawing with Kleeman. And I thank you for that. I do see that your time is lapsing and we haven't really addressed your view on the burden of proof. I mean, I know what it is based on your brief. And I think that you primarily rely on the Lumberman's case. Is that right? I have to tell you that I'm a little troubled by some of the language in Lumberman's, not so much the fact that that is a case that involved initial permissive use, but the fact that that's a case where the district or the Supreme Court stated the burden of proof and placed it on the quote named insured, right? The named insured. And it really was, it's a coverage case. It's a declaratory judgment action, right? Which this obviously is not. This isn't a coverage case, it's a subrogation case. So help me out in understanding whether the language that you're clinging to in Lumberman's really is binding on this court and does in fact establish that the burden of proof is on Namara to prove, as the district court found, to prove implied consent was not given.
Your Honor, in some ways, I think that there's no other way that it can be, because this is similar to a res ipsa loquitur type of a case. The injured party in an automobile collision like this, or its insurer, the facts for them start at the collision. It would require discovery and other steps to try to figure out what happened. The car was in the possession, it's owned by the appellant, it's owned by the owner under the Safety Responsibility Act. And so I think that the burden shifting, because the plaintiff would typically have all the burden of proof, which we did in this case on damages, which we did on the case on negligence. But with regard to permissive use, all of this occurs before the plaintiff is even brought into the case. And the only two people that know what was done with regard to permissive use, especially in this case where there's no one else living in this home, this building, are these two people. And they're... Respondent was a little bit attacked because we didn't bring in Mr. Traore. Mr. Traore is, let me put it this way. There's nothing in the record to say that we should have brought him in, and there's nothing in the record to show that we couldn't find him. But to throw that burden on us to try to find him and bring him in, I think it goes against public policy of having the owner who is responsible to insure the car to provide this coverage under the No Fault Act and the Safety Responsibility Act. Those two things provide coverage for people that are injured. And I think the Lumberman's case, and I think all of these cases that address burden of proof, Shuck and Lumberman's, I think should be followed by basically public policy. in order to have the owner liable, unless they have not provided permission, implied or expressed, and left his keys in the car available to somebody who's homeless there.
So I guess I have one last question for you, Mr. Young. So what case do you think, looking through the rather long list of cases that have been decided under this act, are the closest to the one that we have here and suggest a result in your favor and affirmance?
Mr. Young, we can't hear you if you're trying to speak.
Can I be, can you hear me now?
Thank
you. I apologize. My landline started ringing and I unplugged it ahead of time and I don't know why. I didn't know it could ring without being plugged in. Was there a question, Your Honor? I see my time ran out. I used it unplugging
the phone. Let me give it to you if the presiding judge is all right with that one more time and just see, since you don't obviously have a rebuttal. So what case would you direct us to that you think is closest to the facts that we have here? There have been so many decided under the act, but that would suggest that we would affirm the district court on its determination that there is implied consent in this case.
I think that the district court using Stewart versus Anderson is a good site, although I cited some cases, the opposite cases in my brief, Your Honor. And with regard to burden of proof, Shuck and Lumberman's. And I know that I said a lot more cases than you asked for.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Hartzman, do you have rebuttal?
Just a couple of points, Your Honor, if I may. This isn't a race ipsa case. There is a burden of proof, and our challenge is not to shifting it once there has been some initial permission, as I think the cases suggest, but shifting it entirely. I don't see that in Lumberman's or Shuck or in the later cases that cite those cases. It's also not a situation where there's absolute liability. The Delwo case made that clear, that even though the Safety Responsibility Act, this provision in particular, will be liberally construed, it doesn't mean that there's absolute liability. In the Delwo case, referring to a parent's liability.
Mr. Horstman, can I stop you and just ask you to summarize for me? What evidence in this record is inconsistent with a determination that your client gave implied consent to Mr. Traore to use this truck?
Well, the keys were not readily available. She put them on the top shelf of a cupboard that was closed. So he had to go find those keys if he was going to use them. There was no prior use. She had no indication from her interactions with Mr. Traore that he was going to drive her truck. He had his own car. He wasn't someone she brought in off the street. He had been staying with another person she knew who no longer had room for him. So she asked Mrs. Namara if she could provide a place for him to stay. So the whole transaction there was shelter. As we noted in our brief, and as when on the other side of this question, Progressive argued, there's never been a case where implied consent has been found where the owner of the car then take some action or have some interaction regarding the vehicle that was used, either rented it or insured it and let somebody use it, or in this case, in most cases, was a parent working things with their, or allowing their children to learn to drive or to drive.
So are you suggesting that consent should be more readily inferred, if you will, when there's a familial relationship between the owner of the vehicle and the person who uses it?
Only, Your Honor, where there has been a situation where the child has actually used the car. And that's why I've looked to Kleeman and Stewart, because they've looked at those situations and have not found implied consent, as counsel indicated.
So the fact that we have a house guest here, as opposed to a sibling, a child, a spouse, doesn't alter the analysis of whether the facts end up to implied consent.
Only to the extent that it makes it less likely that there was any interaction or action by the owner that would imply consent. When you have a dinner guest, if you have your keys sitting in a dish or on a hook or something, you're not implying that your dinner guest can come and just take your keys and drive off with your car. They're there to share a meal with you, not to take your car for their own transportation. Mr. Traore was there because someone agreed to provide him a place to sleep, not because they were providing transportation for him. He had that. He had his own car. So I think it's not just the relationship, but the interactions that you'd expect to see in that relationship. And that's probably why it arises most often in the parent-child setting. Those are the only points I had, unless there are other questions I should respond to. Thank you, Your Honors.
I see no further questions. Thank you both for your arguments today. We will take the matter under advisement and issue our decision within the statutory 90-day period. Thank you both. We will now recess in preparation to consider our next case. Thank you.
Thank you.